Good morning, I'm Jackie Judd. The Speaker of Iran's parliament says the United States will definitely have to meet more requirements for the release of the hostages than those outlined last week by the Ayatollah Khomeini. One demand is an apology from the U.S. That was omitted from Khomeini's list, which did include a return of the late Shah's fortune and a promise of no further U.S. intervention in Iran. Parliamentary debate on the hostages is supposed to begin tomorrow, 318 days after they were captured. Meanwhile, the Iranian news agency is reporting that families of the hostages have sent the speaker a letter asking for a meeting so the problem can be solved in a human atmosphere. Efforts by some OPEC ministers for long-range planning are being complicated by internal fighting among some of the member nations. A report from Bob Kaler in Vienna.
A special meeting of OPEC foreign, oil, and finance ministers went into closed session as soon as it opened. It's officially being held to complete long-term strategy plans for a summit of OPEC heads of state that's scheduled for Baghdad in November. Hardline states have already opposed one feature of those plans aimed at imposing an orderly system of price adjustments on OPEC producers. And the members are also squabbling about whether to cut the amount of oil available on the world market. And hanging over it all is the border fighting between Iran and Iraq, which threatens to become a bitter issue at the conference between Iranian and Iraqi ministers. Bob Kaler in Vienna.
Energy Department officials have been summoned to Capitol Hill today to testify before a House Energy Subcommittee on the administration's oil reserve policy. Back in 1978, during a shortage, the practice of keeping a billion barrels in emergency reserve was suspended. Energy Secretary Duncan testified earlier that beginning in June, the reserve would be built up. The committee wants to know why that hasn't happened. Government sources in Ankara, Turkey, say the country's new military rulers have arrested hundreds of suspected terrorists and political extremists, and that a purge of local civilian governments is imminent. The army leaders also are trying to convince the outside world of its legitimacy. John Spicer has a report.
The military leaders are underlining this morning that organizations like the International Monetary Fund need have no fears concerning agreements made by the previous government. They say that all international agreements made by the government before the coup will be honored, and they particularly stress that they'll be loyal to those agreements aimed at stabilizing Turkey's economy. Turkey has huge loans from the IMF and is seeking more economic aid. The announcement comes as the country takes more steps towards normality, with the banks reopening as well as offices and government buildings. Strikers have been ordered back today. The six-man National Security Council has banned strikes in a series of measures announced yesterday. The order affects 70,000 workers in the metal and textile industries who've been on strike for 6 months. John Spicer, BBC, Ankara.
President Carter is on his way to Texas for the start of a two-day campaign swing through the South and then up to Ohio. Behind him in Washington, Mr. Carter left a campaign staff minus a campaign manager. Tim Kraft has taken a leave of absence because of a federal investigation into allegations that he used cocaine 3 years ago. The U.S. Civil Rights Commission has completed a 3-year investigation of U.S. immigration procedures, and it's recommending the end of quotas on the number of immigrants allowed into the U.S. from particular countries, in favor instead of a worldwide ceiling, a sort of first-come, first-served system. The commission says the current procedure is discriminatory. Schools in Philadelphia are closed again today. City officials are unable to open them because of a teachers' strike that has now entered its third week. Strikes across the country are affecting 500,000 students. In Los Angeles, school is opening tomorrow amid more confusion than usual. That's because of a new busing plan. Jim Thompson has a report.
As the beginning of school in Los Angeles draws near, the district's integration program is still no closer to being settled. The watchword here is confusion. School districts are expected to be working up to the last minute, assigning teachers, routing buses, and notifying parents where their children are to report for school. All of this last-minute work and confusion has been brought about by a series of court decisions in the past few days, which has changed and then rechanged the plan. The latest order essentially allows the Board of Education to decide which schools must participate in the mandatory busing program. Proponents of busing believe that order goes against the essence of the integration plan, and they say more legal action is on the way, and that surely will change things once again. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Thompson in Los Angeles.
A weekend of Ku Klux Klan rallies in Scotland, Connecticut ended quietly last night. 200 to 300 people gathered in a pasture to listen to speeches calling for white supremacy, and then they set fire to a 15-foot cross. We have details from NPR's Neil Conan.
After scattered violence and tension on Saturday, it seemed as if everybody was too tired to stage a full-blown repeat. Bill Wilkinson, the Imperial Wizard, wore the same blue polyester suit and looked haggard as he lopped Saturday's speech nearly in half. A few minutes later, he led Connecticut's second cross-burning in 70 years. He distributed literature and Klan membership applications afterwards. Yesterday afternoon, Wilkinson was arrested by the state police for carrying a loaded .45 caliber pistol in the trunk of his car. After being released on his own recognizance, Wilkinson said the gun wasn't loaded. Police were out again in large numbers yesterday, but were far more relaxed since there were none of the counter-demonstrations of Saturday. I'm Neil Conan, National Public Radio in Hartford, Connecticut.
A Cuban refugee who came to this country in the early 60s is in jail this morning after allegedly making an unsuccessful hijack attempt to Havana. Eastern Airline officials say the man threatened to detonate a bomb, but the pilot called his bluff and flew the plane on its scheduled route from Tampa to Miami. A Saudi military aircraft has crashed, killing all 89 people on board. The American-built C-130 transport plane crashed near the holy city of Medina, close to the Red Sea. It's the second air disaster in Saudi Arabia inside a month. Here's Paul Martin in Cairo.
A Saudi military spokesman said all the Saudi military personnel on board were killed. The Hercules transport aircraft, the basic workhorse of the Air Force, is just one of several United States planes that the Saudis have been getting. The U.S. has been quietly training and equipping the Saudis, which until recently had only rudimentary forces. The Saudis have major plans for expansion and the construction of new bases, and they're also demanding major improvements to the range and firepower of the highly sophisticated F-15 jet fighters, which the U.S. Congress approved 2 years ago after a fierce row. Israel, which strongly opposed the original deal, is now furious that the U.S. appears likely to agree to the Saudi demands, which Israel says breaks pledges given by the U.S. United States military personnel in the Middle East say supplying and training the Saudis is like stepping on raw eggs. For National Public Radio, this is Paul Martin in Cairo.
Actor Jimmy Stewart is back at home after a five-day stay at a Santa Monica hospital for treatment of sciatica, a nerve ailment. A hospital spokesman says Stewart left in good condition. He was in the hospital last month, too, that time for a heart ailment. I'm Jackie Jotty in Washington, 9:30 past the hour.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. President Carter is without a key man in his campaign this morning. Tim Kraft, the National Carter Mondale campaign manager, is taking a leave of absence while a special prosecutor investigates charges that Kraft used cocaine when he was a member of the president's staff. Those claims were made by a White House aide to a special prosecutor who was investigating similar charges against Hamilton Jordan, who was then White House chief of staff and now a top Carter strategist. NPR's White House correspondent Carolyn Craven reports.
President Carter's campaign manager, Tim Kraft, says he is taking a leave of absence from the campaign in order to avoid the political exploitation of the cocaine use charges being leveled against him. Campaign aides say the decision to leave the campaign was Kraft's alone because of his concern for the president. In a statement from Kraft released yesterday, Kraft says, quote, "I have not worked hard for President Carter for the past 6 years just to become a subject of political controversy in the last 6 weeks of his reelection campaign." Kraft says he learned of the investigation a month ago and volunteered for an FBI interview where he denied the allegations. Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti asked a three-judge panel to name a special prosecutor to investigate Kraft as a result of evidence uncovered in an investigation which eventually cleared former White House Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan of cocaine charges. According to sources, a White House aide testified during the Jordan case that Kraft had used cocaine in New Orleans in 1969. 1977. The special prosecutor chosen for the Kraft investigation, New Orleans attorney Gerald Gallinghouse, a Republican, had no comment on the matter Sunday evening. Tim Kraft, who is 39, began working for Jimmy Carter's first presidential campaign in 1975. A key organizer then, Kraft joined the White House staff after the election, first as an appointment secretary to the president and later on Hamilton Jordan's staff as a presidential assistant for political affairs. Earlier this year, Kraft left the White House to become manager of the Carter-Mondale reelection campaign. Campaign chairman Robert Strauss said yesterday that he regrets the loss of a fine young man who has categorically denied the charges. Strauss says he has no doubt that Kraft will be vindicated, noting that the appointment of a special prosecutor is in no way an indication of guilt or wrongdoing. Campaign aides say no decision has been made as to whether or not someone will be named to replace Kraft. They also say that in addition to whatever political use presidential opponents make of the case, Kraft's leaving will hurt the campaign because of his skills as an organizer and political strategist. He's the best nuts and bolts guy we have in the campaign, one aide said. Kraft, who was unavailable for interviews, spent yesterday talking with campaign staff here in Washington and calling campaign coordinators around the country, explaining why he is leaving the campaign and urging them to continue working hard for the president's reelection. Because of his long association with Jimmy Carter and Carter supporters around the country, one aide said the conversations were particularly painful, but that Kraft held up better than most of the rest of the staff. Kraft is reportedly taking a leave of absence rather than quitting the campaign in order to stay on the payroll to help pay for what may be a lengthy and expensive investigation for him. Aides say Kraft did not talk with the president before making his decision. It was not known whether he and Mr. Carter have spoken since. I'm Carolyn Craven in Washington.
President Carter flies south today. His first stop is Texas. This is the president's first overnight trip in the fall campaign. The president is scheduled to hold a town hall meeting in Corpus Christi this morning before going on to Houston for a Democratic National Committee fundraiser and a rally for campaign volunteers. And his Republican opponent won't be far behind him. Ronald Reagan will go to Texas after a brief stop here in Washington today. NPR's national political correspondent Linda Wertheimer reports.
This is a week of extravaganzas for Governor Ronald Reagan, starting today with a long picture-taking session with all the Republican nominees for the House and Senate, individually for their own campaign purposes, and all together in a giant congressional rally on the steps of the Capitol, in which Reagan plans to make the point that it is often not possible for a president to accomplish what he wants without a cooperative Congress. The Democrats have controlled Congress for many years with only brief interruptions by Republicans, but this year and in 1982, Republicans could make considerable headway toward taking over the Senate. In a move somewhat unusual for a presidential candidate, they generally would have us believe they can do it all by themselves, Ronald Reagan is lending the support of his campaign to the effort to elect a Republican Congress. And then the governor goes to Texas, a major battleground state, where he will attend Mexican Independence Day celebrations in San Antonio, looking for Mexican-American votes. If Governor Reagan can head off a large turnout of Texas Spanish-speaking voters toward President Carter, it helps his effort to capture Texas. And if Texas was not already persuaded of its importance in this campaign, on Tuesday, Governor Reagan, former President Ford, and vice presidential nominee George Bush will all be in Houston for a fundraiser for the Texas Republican Party. After that, Governor Reagan returns to Washington for a few days of preparation for the last extravaganza of the week, a two-ring circus in Baltimore. The League of Women Voters debate with independent candidate John Anderson and, representing President Carter, an empty chair. The Reagan camp remains confident that President Carter has underestimated the consequences of asking for debates, then refusing to show up if John Anderson is participating. They believe the debates will give both candidates a chance to go after the absent president's record on the economy and on relations overseas, and the Reagan camp hopes to be able to fence John Anderson into territory that will make moderate and regular Republican voters choose Reagan. I'm Linda Wertheimer, in Washington.
A poll by the Washington Post says Carter and Reagan each have about 37% of the popular vote, while independent John Anderson has 13%. But the poll says President Carter would lose the election if it were held today. Anderson's running mate, Patrick Lucey, predicts the president will come in third in the November elections. On NBC's Meet the Press, the former Wisconsin governor said he feels that President Carter's empty chair at the debate in Baltimore will be a plus for the independent ticket.
I think that if the American people have a chance to look at John Anderson on an equal footing with the offerings of the two traditional parties, they're going to recognize that he is by far the best qualified candidate to be president of the United States. And they're going to find out that he has specific proposals to solve some of the nagging problems that we've been faced with for a long time, and that he's prepared to reverse the process that has been going on for the last 10 years or more, where we've simply been resting on our laurels, we have not been able to reinvest, we have not been willing to improve the productivity of this country, we have been willing to forego really a competitive stance in world trade.
Lucey also answered President Carter's charges that Anderson is a creation of the media, a man without a party, a convention, or a single primary win.
Obviously he doesn't have a party, he's the independent candidate. Thousands and thousands of people all over this country have been working for months for John Anderson. More than 2 million people signed petitions to get him on the ballot in all 50 states and in the District of Columbia. Now that 2 million is a rather significant number. Only about 19 million participated in both parties in the whole nominating process. So I think that John Anderson is a real candidate. I think it's an insult to his backers to suggest that he is merely a creature of the press. All political campaigns are influenced by the press and by media.
Former ambassador to Mexico, Patrick Lucey, John Anderson's running mate on the independent ticket. He spoke on the NBC interview program Meet the Press. The time is now 19 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. 690 Detroit police officers have been laid off. That's about 15% of the entire force. The cutbacks were ordered by City Hall as the result of a recession-ravaged budget. Ironically, many of those laid off are not angry with the mayor, but rather with their union, the Detroit Police Officers Association. Emma Lockridge reports.
Of the nearly 700 police officers laid off, 75% were blacks or women. Many of them are angry at their union because they feel affirmative action gains were not protected, even though their contract says layoffs should go by seniority. Officer Deneen Harvey had been on the force 3 years before she was pink-slipped.
As far as the blacks are concerned, we haven't seen any dependency from the union, or we haven't had anything, no papers, no literature, nothing saying that they are there to help us. The only union that has stood behind us throughout the whole layoff is the Guardians. I don't know what kind of racial aspect that would be, but as far as a union is concerned on a job, that union is there to protect you and your job. The DPOA union hasn't done that so far.
Your union didn't lay you off. It was City Hall and the Coleman Young administration. So why are so many of the pink-slipped officers disgruntled with the union?
The mayor asked them to take a pay cut. They refused to take the pay cut. The mayor also asked them to limit the hours of working. The union refused that. Now, if the union had settled one or two of the issues, I don't think as many of us would be laid off today.
Since layoffs go by seniority, suppose the situation was reversed, say you had 20 years on the force, would you be willing to make sacrifices to keep other officers on the payroll?
As far as our income as a police officer, we are the most and high paid officers in the United States of America. A pay cut really shouldn't hurt us. It shouldn't.
Back in 1967, during the riots, only about 6% of the Detroit police force were minorities. One high-level police officer recently referred to that membership as an occupying army. Through aggressive affirmative action hires, the force has lost that reputation. And now, with the minority layoffs, Officer Harvey believes the force won't be as effective with white males filling minority slots. She thinks they lack the sensitivity to understand and deal with minority-related problems.
I think we can talk and approach them better without a macho attitude, I am the boss. You know, we go out and get a run. And it's a black situation where a black officer handles it better than the white officer, because the black citizen or the black person in that community will relate better to the black person or black officer.
Officer Harvey earned $23,000 per year before being laid off. She is single with no dependents and thinks she can survive the layoffs. However, she says her pot set aside for rainy days is running low. Relocation is one possibility for her, but she would like to stay in Detroit. So at this point, she's taking a wait-and-see attitude, hoping to be called back to her job. For National Public Radio, this is Emma Lockridge in Detroit.
In Pennsylvania, the numbers game has always been popular, even when it was illegal. Now that the state has taken it over, it's even more popular. It does about $1 million a day in business, and it's expected to exceed a gross of $300 million this year. The net profits after the payoff go to benefit senior citizens, to provide free mass transit rides and tax breaks. Pennsylvania has a number of lotteries, but in a particular one, the three-digit figure is determined by numbered ping-pong balls that are blown out of an elaborate bingo machine. NPR's Brenda Wilson prepared this report.
You have three of these bingo machines.
Okay.
And 10 balls in them, numbered 0 to 9. And it has a mixing arm in the bottom of the machine and a blower that blows the ball
Tony
up.
Tony Pasqualis is a reporter with the Morning News of Erie, Pennsylvania, who has become embroiled in heavy speculation about the state's numbers game that many suspect was rigged. First, Pasqualis describes how the state's ping pong lottery works.
Ping pong or gaming type balls in the bottom. Blows one of these balls up the machine, and the three that come up is the number for that day, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever.
A set of sluggish ping pong balls has state revenue officials and Pennsylvania's Governor Thornburgh worried that its profitable numbers game is in danger. Rumors abound, fed by reports flowing up from a reputed unidentified underworld figure, that Pennsylvania's state-run ping-pong lottery of April 24th was rigged. The word was out, they say, before the bets were laid, that the number would be sixes or fours. Although the betting on triple numbers are usually high, some of the heaviest betting yet was placed on 666, and it paid off. At first, Thornburgh's administration denied that it was possible to fix the games, but videotapes of the April 24th drawing shown at a recent press conference suggest that eight or so of the balls in each of the machines were listless. Only one or two were popping up, which added to allegations that something was amiss. Tony Pasqualis undertook his own investigation.
We're not saying that that particular day's drawing was rigged. Obviously, we can't prove that. After all this surfaced, I was able to find a machine almost identical to the ones used by the state, these bingo machines, okay? I was able to fiddle with the balls, and we did many things to them. Well, we wanted to conduct an experiment just to find out if there was a way to alter the balls or the machine to make one or two numbers come up consistently.
Okay.
We were able to do that, finally, by injecting water into the balls.
The balls, of course, which had no water in them, were lighter, rose easier, and were hypothetically labeled 666. Governor Thornburgh says Pasquale's experiments prove nothing new. The elaborate security precautions taken by the state should have ruled out a fix.
Now, all indications are that the state has taken great pains to make it that. With these 12 drawings, the balls they spend about $100 on each ball by the time they're put in the machine. They're weighed several times during the process. They're transported by state police to Pittsburgh, kept under a double lock at the television station there. There's a lot of caretaking by the state in it, and there's no doubt about it that the strength of the lottery runs on people accepting it as an honestly run game.
Governor Thornburg has accused underworld figures of resorting to smear tactics to sabotage the state's lottery system. Illegal bookies often play along with the game, but claim they voided payoffs on the April 24th drawing. Pasquales doubts that.
I find that kind of odd because generally, from the sources we've been able to talk to, the illegals game lays off their heavy bets onto the state lottery. Let me explain how that works. If somebody is getting a heavy bet on the number 7, 8, 9, and he's an illegal bookie, and if it comes in, it's going to really, he's going to maybe have to pay out more than he has. All he does is buy himself some insurance. He takes 10, 15, maybe has $20 worth of bets. That's a lot of bets at 600 to 1 odds. And if it comes in, it's going to hurt him. So he takes $15, $20 or whatever, and he walks down and buys the legal number. And if the number does come in, he can pay off his people with the proceeds from the legal game.
Pennsylvania's revenue secretary has turned up contradictory findings, and a statewide grand jury has been called in to investigate all of the allegations. The records of betting patterns have been impounded pending the outcome of the investigation, and the state Senate, which regards the ping pong lottery as its own pet project, has gotten into the act with its own investigation. They're now in a tug of war with the administration over who has access to the records. The administration fears the Senate may jeopardize its investigation. In the meantime, the game goes on, and gamblers being who they are, the sales haven't suffered at all. For National Public Radio, this is Brenda Wilson.
Good morning, I'm Bob Edwards. Television was supposed to begin the new fall season tonight, but the actors' strike has kept us watching reruns. Now the actors themselves may be picketed as they try to put on a strike benefit show tomorrow night. It seems the Teamsters have become disenchanted with the strike that has put 2,000 of its members out of work, and the stagehands say they'll honor the picket lines. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition.
Good morning, I'm Carl Castle. The Speaker of Iran's parliament brought a new element into the American hostage situation today. He said the parliament will definitely add to the conditions set by the Ayatollah Khomeini for their release. 3 days ago, Khomeini said the Americans could be freed if the United States returned the late Shah's wealth, unblocked frozen Iranian assets, dropped financial claims against Iran, and promised not to interfere in Iran's affairs. Today, the speaker said the Ayatollah did not mention all the conditions, and that one will include an American apology for its former involvement in Iran. The speaker did say that hostage issues will be taken up by the parliament beginning tomorrow. Later today in Washington, Secretary of State Muskie holds a news conference in which he is expected to break the administration's silence on the new developments. Turkey is reported quiet today. Stores are open again following Friday's military takeover and a one-day curfew. The new government stepped into a scattering of labor disputes, offering striking workers a pay raise and then ordering them back to work. The plan seems to have worked. Another priority of the country's new military council is winning and keeping the confidence of international bankers. It promised that all international agreements made by the old government will be honored. A report from the BBC's Jack Spicer in Ankara.
They say all transactions relevant to imports and exports will be resumed under existing legislation. They're to introduce measures to stop the withdrawal of excessive or speculative amounts of money from banks. And they state that with foreign currency assets standing at $1,000 million, they can meet import bills, especially for oil and petroleum products. While these heavyweight and vital assurances are given, the struggle to end terrorism goes on. The military says that army commanders in just six areas have rounded up 182 suspects and seized a number of guns and rifles. And the figures indicate that possibly hundreds more suspected terrorists and criminals will be dealt with. The military commander in Adana, in southern Turkey, has confirmed that an army tank corps captain was killed last night by terrorists. It's the first such incident reported since the coup last Friday.
The BBC's Jack Spicer in Ankara. Jimmy Carter flew to Texas this morning for an overnight campaign trip that will also take him to Georgia, South Carolina, and Cleveland. His campaign is now minus National Campaign Manager Tim Kraft, who took a leave of absence yesterday when it was revealed that he is under investigation on cocaine charges. A special prosecutor has been chosen to look into the matter. Kraft denies the charge. He is the third high-level Carter aide to become involved in a drug controversy. Ronald Reagan heads for Texas today. He will spend 2 days there trying to wrap up the state's 26 electoral votes. Recent polls show him slightly ahead of the president. John Anderson, who has campaigned the past few days in California, heads north to Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington. As the third week of the current school term begins, about a half million youngsters are still out because of teacher strikes. There have been some smaller settlements, but the biggest walkout in Philadelphia continues with no prospects for an early end. Striking actors and producers get together again today to try and work out an end to their strike, which is nearly 2 months old. And the strike against the California wine industry is now another day old. A report from David Stiebel in San Francisco.
The only thing standing between striking wine workers, management, and a new contract is 2 percentage points. The wineries are offering a pay raise of 28% over 3 years, while the union wants 30%. And while the difference may seem small, a lawyer for the Winery Association, Arthur Mendelson, says it's big money.
You know, 2% doesn't sound like a great deal, but each percentage point to our members is worth about $574,000 a year.
Even so, the wineries say they increased their wage offer from 27 to 28% at Saturday's bargaining session. They also backed off on their demand to increase probationary periods for new employees. That had been a key issue. The union feels that management did offer significant concessions, but employees say they also gave a lot in earlier negotiations. So workers turned down the winery's proposal and offered no counterproposal. For National Public Radio, this is David Stiebel in San Francisco.
And reporting from Washington, I'm Carl Castle.